It is 50 degrees, Kenosha and Racine, 48 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got that string around my finger. Is this beautiful thing? As long as I hold the string, I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got that string around my finger. What a world!
That remarkable singing actually belongs to a talented singer by the name of Steve Lippia. And Steve Lippia is one of the centerpieces of this upcoming 76th season of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. The symphony is so excited to have singer Steve Lippia coming to perform with them on October 17th, 7 p.m. in Reuther High School Auditorium, a concert which is titled Centennial Celebration, a Frank Sinatra Tribute. 2015 marks the centennial year of the birth of Frank Sinatra, born on December 12th, 1915. And one of a number of events around the area which are going to surround that landmark will be this exciting concert with the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. Steve Lippia's impressive career and busy resume encompasses a whole lot more than the songs of Frank Sinatra, but as you've just heard, he does a remarkable job of evoking Frank Sinatra's magic and while also retaining his own special warmth and charisma as a singer. He performs all kinds of different works out of the Great American Songbook and has a very, very busy and successful career. And we're going to spend a few moments now talking with Steve Lippia about his career and about what we can expect in this exciting concert coming up on October 17th. Steve Lippia, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
I'm glad we have this opportunity. Let's find out first a little bit about your roots. Where do you come from originally? And how soon in your life did music and specifically singing become really important to you?
I grew up in Connecticut, born and raised. And my mom was a wonderful singer. She sang for a few years in her late teens. And then, you know, started studying nursing and then met my dad and got married. And so she kind of put that whole track, I guess you could say, on hold. And so those were the earliest sounds that I heard were from my mom just around the house singing this kind of music. So for me, it was always kind of there in the background, at least. And I was never really on a this sort of path to where I am now. It was not something that was sort of predetermined. It really kind of came about through happenstance. I had done a lot of other things prior to pursuing music as a career. Had gone to college and then grad school and had worked on Wall Street for a little while. And it was probably right after high school that I started, kind of got the bug, I guess you could say, with the standards and big band music. And I started singing with a Hartford, Connecticut-based band, Bobby K. Orchestra. And I sang with them for better than 10 years. But it was just it was a part-time thing. It was just something I did. It was fun, but it was, I guess you could say, it was kind of a purposeful and serious type of fun. I just started out really as a sort of the band boy, helping to as a roadie, setting up the band and taking down the music stands and the speakers and setting up the sound system and all that. And little by little, I got worked into the program as a singer, which was my original goal, as I started to understand the music better and get some music arrangements written. So it was a rather unusual path, I think, to get to where I am now.
I guess so. So, for instance, in high school, you weren't one of those kind of music nerds who sang in the choir and so on. Music wasn't really central to your life, just something you kind of did on the side?
Well, I did sing, actually, in chorus. You know, sang. It was classical music.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a Catholic high school, St. Paul Catholic High School in Bristol, Connecticut, just next door to Southington. And was involved in, you know, a few different music activities, but it was just something that I enjoyed, and I never really expected to do anything about it. Because really, the kind of music that I thought I would be good at was really not very popular. I mean, I loved listening to going to concerts that were based on rock and roll music, but what I think really kind of drove my interest was really the standards, better known as the Popular American Songbook. And I didn't really see much of a future in that. So I just kind of, privately enjoyed that kind of music, I guess you could say. I didn't have a big record collection or anything like that. My house wasn't a house filled with music all the time. But I just always thought that the great singers of standards, Tony Bennett, Bobby Darin, Vic Damone, Nat King Cole, I just thought, and would have to even go back as far as Bing Crosby, were very amazing artists.
And it was hard for you to think about yourself in their company or professionally performing that kind of music, even though listening to it and privately singing it gave you a lot of pleasure. So
yes, I just didn't see it as viable anymore. I thought I was just born about 50 years too late.
As you first started actually doing this, would we recognize the sound that we were listening to just now? That is, right from the start, did you have this remarkable affinity with the style and for that matter, also this remarkable vocal resemblance to some of the singers that you just talked about, including Frank Sinatra? Or is that something that's kind of developed over time?
No, I think it was kind of there right from the start. And I recognized that, and I recognized that it was most suitable for, let's say, you know, singing standards than it would be for, you know, singing in a Led Zeppelin tribute band. So when I was in high school, I was in the variety show, junior and senior year. And it was in junior year when I had sung a couple of standards that people started sort of taking notice and telling me that, wow, you know, you sound a little bit like a couple of different singers. They mentioned Steve Lawrence, and they mentioned Frank Sinatra. And I started to kind of listen to them and thought, well, you know, maybe this is the kind of music that I should spend more time with, and maybe I would like to perform this music more than just around the house.
We're talking with Steve Lippia. He is a singer who is coming to Kenosha to perform with the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra on the 17th of October, 7:30 p.m., a concert which is called Centennial Celebration, a Frank Sinatra Tribute. It will be a tribute to the great Frank Sinatra in this, the 100th anniversary of his birth. Steve Lippia, as you approach these songs that have been made famous for decades now by great, great singers of the past, many of them no longer with us, and a few of them still, such as Tony Bennett, what is it that goes through your mind kind of artistically in terms of making your performance your own? I mean, making this a Steve Lippia performance versus a performance which also evokes unmistakable memories of some of these great singers we're talking about. I suspect that that's kind of a tricky matter, maybe. Or do you not give it a lot of conscious thought and just sort of go with what your instincts tell you to do?
In the performance of it, Greg, I don't worry about that sort of thing. But certainly in interviews and in talking about the material, it becomes more of a conscious effort. When I'm on stage, I really try to be in the moment. And basically, it's kind of like what Linda Ronstadt said. You don't have to be original. You just need to be authentic. And I think if you're very authentic and sincere in telling the story that these great songs tell, and finding some way to be authentic about the phrasing and the style of the music, the great elegance that it lends itself to, that people will connect to that kind of emotional reality. If you come off as trying to be someone else or look or talk like somebody else, I think it demeans both the artist who's doing the imitation and the original artist. Nobody wins. So I never step into that territory. I really try to be myself. And certainly I've borrowed from a lot of different singers. I think everyone who sings has learned from someone, and I certainly have, in terms of phrasing and styling and that sort of thing.
And I guess my second question is, has it always been like that, or did you sort of arrive at this understanding that you just articulated so well? Or in the early going, as you were first doing it, I mean, were you tempted to, in a sense, be a Tony Bennett impersonator or a Frank Sinatra impersonator and then refine that idea? Or right from the start, were you anxious to, in a sense, be your own artist as much as possible?
I think I understood that quite early. I really tried to avoid being drawn in, pulled in to a place where I was copying somebody. I have a distaste for that kind of thing. I mean, it's a different matter when you're trying to be an impressionist. There are certain people out there who do a great job of that, and that's exactly what they're attempting to do. That's not what I do. So for me, it was something I always tried to avoid and try to be authentic, try to be genuine, and treat the music with a certain amount of respect. But I always realized, I guess even since probably high school, that there was always a danger of walking sort of close to the fire.
I appreciate that fact, and I think you do achieve what you just described very, very well, remarkably well. When you think about some of these great singers, that we've been talking about, Tony Bennett, Bobby Darin, Vic Damone, Nat King Cole, Steve Lawrence, do you tend to kind of think of them all in the same breath, or are there one or two of them that you especially esteem?
Certainly, if I'm covering a song that they're known for, there's no way that I could, you know, sing that song without having some awareness at some point of their versions. There is kind of a tendency for certain artists to kind of preempt, I think, almost all other versions of a song because they have such a signature way of interpreting that song. So I think to that extent that sometimes that I'm aware of those kinds of influences. You know, if you hear, you know, Stepping Out with My Baby or I Left My Heart in San Francisco, well, it's clearly, you know, or The Good Life, it's a Tony Bennett song. Even though many other artists have recorded it, if you hear My Way or I Guess I'll Hang My Tears Out to Dry or Fly Me to the Moon, it's hard to think of anyone else other than Frank Sinatra. So to that extent, I'm certainly aware of those influences. You know, my voice is probably closest somewhere between Steve Lawrence and Sinatra, naturally. But it's not that's not a totally new phenomenon if you look at people like Harry Connick Jr. and Michael Bublé, who clearly were influenced by a number of singers, including Sinatra. I think what makes it more challenging for someone like me is I don't have kind of what I would call the household name. I have some name recognition, but I'm not a household name. If I had a television show or several hits, then people would say, okay, that's Steve Lippia, and he's just covering somebody else's songs. But when you are out there and you're performing a thematic song, like a thematic show like Centennial Sinatra, people are wondering, well, okay, so who is this guy, and how is he going to treat this material? Is he going to be trying to imitate him? Is he somehow just honoring him as a tribute? Where is that fine line? But if Tony Bennett is covering the music of Frank Sinatra, nobody expects him to put on a fedora and a pinky ring and talk like he's from New Jersey.
Right.
So I think it's just that kind of, you know, notoriety that helps other artists avoid that kind of mistaken identity.
We're speaking with Steve Lippia, who is going to be singing with the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra for their first concert of their 76th season on October 17th, a concert which the symphony is calling Centennial Celebration of Frank Sinatra Tribute. This is the 100th anniversary year of Frank Sinatra's birth. Steve Lippia, maybe we could just spend a couple of minutes talking about what you feel made Frank Sinatra so particularly great. I mean, he achieved a level of fame and success that that really was unlike any other similar entertainer of his generation. And of course, one thing is he spanned several generations. I mean, just the longevity of his career was pretty remarkable, but there was far beyond that. As far as you're concerned, as someone who has studied him and of course knows his career better than most of us, what would you say were the key ingredients that made him such a distinctive artist who is still remembered so vividly and so widely revered?
There are so many factors, I think, that determine the depth and breadth of his success and his influence on pop culture that you could teach a class on it, I think, an entire semester on it. But there was a lot that was purposeful and a lot of it was happenstance. I think he was born at the right time. And that means in terms of where our music was culturally, in terms of World War II, I think that he was the right guy for this type of music. Perhaps if Frank Sinatra were born in 1948 or 1950, I'm not sure that he would have had success as a rock singer. I don't know that would translate. Clearly, he would be singing the music differently than, you know, the music that we know him for. And I sometimes ask myself, what would have happened to Pavarotti if he were born in the Mississippi Delta and hadn't been introduced as a young man to opera? You know,
great question.
And you know, people sometimes I think are quick to kind of pigeonhole a singer and say, well, that's the extent of that singer's, you know, male or female, their vocal range, but. You know, if Frank Sinatra were born in Belgium, we probably would never know about him. So a lot of it is just kind of a certain amount, right guy, right time, right place. Now, in terms of his innate abilities, I think that he was an incredible combination of what I would say would be great musical instinct and great musical intellect. I think he was a very bright man. He truly was a student of the music, was really a person who had delved very deeply into the whole meaning of this music and telling the story. And he, although he wasn't formally trained very much, he had a very deep understanding of music, perhaps more than most people who taught this sort of thing. And I think, again, another factor that played into it was his own personal story. And I think that was the fuel, the emotional fuel for Frank Sinatra, that you have to have a need and a want and a hunger to tell a story. And it's that kind of emotionalism that people connect to, if it's genuine. If it's not, you know, audiences have a very, very high degree of understanding of authenticity. and I think he was very authentic. He took a style of music that he did not create, but he certainly sort of recreated and rearranged, and to a great extent, I think, made it his own. I always say that had there not been a Bing Crosby, there probably would not have been Frank Sinatra. And he revered Bing as a young man, tried to dress like him, studied his music, and then started thinking more broadly and would travel across the Hudson River from Hoboken, New Jersey, into Manhattan, and would listen to people, other singers of the day, Billie Holiday and Mabel Mercer, and would try to gain a deeper understanding of the music. But the other thing I think that really made a difference for Frank Sinatra was also, yes, his longevity and his productiveness. He was a very prolific recording artist. He recorded close to 1,500 songs.
Wow.
I mean, find me an artist who's recorded half as many as that. It's just unbelievable. And, yes, he had, you know, one of the greatest pop careers. I would say probably the greatest. I don't mean that he was necessarily the one and only greatest singer that ever was. There were a lot of great singers who are recognized for other qualities in their music. But name someone who has recorded in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So when you look at someone like Michael Jackson, yes, whose life did come to an end rather abruptly, or you look at the Beatles, whose band broke up in the early 70s, really was only around for about 10 years. And you look at the life of Elvis, also another artist whose life came to an abrupt end. Those are some of the biggest names in the business, and yet I think that his career, not just because of the longevity, but in part due to that, I think his career is probably the single most amazing phenomenon in pop music.
I was really staggered as I looked over your website and saw kind of the resume of all of the places all across the country where you have performed with all kinds of really impressive groups in a lot of great places. One of the things I kind of wonder about is in most of the performances I've heard, it sounds like you're performing with, you know, kind of the relatively small and snappy sort of group that we immediately associate with a singer like a Frank Sinatra. But of course, on October 17th, you're going to be singing with a symphony orchestra. And I know you've done that, in fact, with some very impressive symphonies from across the country. What does that feel like when you step in front of that kind of a group? And is there kind of a special challenge involved in getting a group that, for instance, most of the time is playing Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven, and maybe on a wild day, Maurice Ravel, to adapt themselves to this kind of music, to this kind of style? And how different does it feel for you as the singer who is standing in front of them?
I liken the two different instrumentations, that of a small, snappy big band, as you called it, versus a symphony, to a comparison between a speedboat, the 10-piece band being the speedboat, where there's a certain kind of immediate acceleration, there's a certain kind of snap, as you talked about, and they can change, a 10-piece band can kind of mold to you and change direction very quickly. And it's a little more stripped bare, but still very musical. And the symphony would be a cruise ship, where you have all of these incredible amenities. You have woodwinds and harp and percussion and French horns and strings. But if you're going to make a quick left turn, you're going to cause a problem. You need to kind of forecast that, because you're moving maybe 60 musicians, hopefully in the same direction around the same time. So there are some notable differences in terms of sort of the finish, as you might say, or the overall affect, but they both have tremendous advantages. I love working with symphonies because they have a broader palette with all of that different kind of instrumentation. And a lot of the original songs that we are kind of recreating were done maybe not with 60 musicians, but oftentimes in the studio with 30 or 36 or 40 musicians, a very similar instrumentation. So when you are trying to perform some kind of beautiful ballad. There's nothing better than having woodwinds and strings to add to what is a big band. So when I'm performing with the Kenosha Symphony, which you're going to hear, at the core is going to still be the big band, but you'll also have the great, great sound that comes from those wonderful orchestral instruments.
Hmm. So it sounds like this gives you a really great pleasure, and it's makes us all the more excited to experience this concert coming up on October 17th. Is this centennial tribute essentially a package which you do quite a lot, or from event to event, do some of the specific song choices change?
It really is mostly a self-contained show. I had one other Sinatra show prior to this called Simply Sinatra, and that was kind of what became kind of a signature show for me that a lot of people associate with me. I mean, I cover, as you talked about earlier, the music of other artists, but that was one that was particularly of interest to people, I think for two reasons. One, because of the vast popularity of Frank Sinatra and his music, even these days later, but also because of my natural similarities vocally to that of Mr. Sinatra's. And so as we were coming upon the time of Frank Sinatra's 100th birth date, I thought, you know, what do I do now? I really would like to spend some time, not just 2015, but the years beyond, celebrating a broader career of this great artist, because most of the music in my first Sinatra show was really 50s and 60s and beyond. I had kind of, I won't say ignored, but really had never delved into his earlier material. So I thought this was a great opportunity to reach further back into the full arc of his career. And I thought, you know, what I would try to do, I can't follow it exactly chronologically, but I would try to work my way through the 30s, 40s, and beyond in a semi-chronological order in the show. And then I thought, well, there are going to be people who have never seen the first show that I did. I can't exclude some of those songs. So it really became kind of an amalgam of both. But there are, I would say there are about 12 new songs in this show as compared to the Simply Sinatra show. Both shows cover about 20 songs. So I start with early stuff, I'll Be Seeing You, Without a Song, The Song Is You, One for the Road, Old Man River, and work my way through the Las Vegas years. You could also, it's interesting, you can look at Frank Sinatra's career in terms of the women he was married to, or you could look at the places that he was known to sing, whether it was in Hoboken or New York City, or touring with the Dorsey Band, and then eventually in Vegas, and then Palm Springs. And you can also look at the different record labels that he was with, you know, with Columbia and with Reprise. And with the arrangers, there are so many ways to look, dimensions within which to sort of study his musical career. I don't dwell on his personal life. It's a very interesting life that he lived. But I do focus on the music, and I talk more about the arrangers and the composers and anecdotal information and some backstories throughout the show in a way to kind of put it in context. It's what I call the dialogue is really kind of the connective tissue between this great body of music.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad you outlined some of the great songs that are going to be part of this concert, which sounds like a tremendous treat for all of us. Again, on the 17th of October, 7:30 p.m. in Reuther High School Auditorium, the Kenosha Symphony, to kick off its 76th season, will present this concert called Centennial Celebration, a Frank Sinatra Tribute, with Steve Lippia. Steve Lippia, it's been a great pleasure for me to speak with you. Very best wishes to you, and we look forward to having you in town very, very soon to share your talents with us. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'll go sailing. It's far.
For more information on Saturday night's concert at Reuther High School Auditorium, you can call the Kenosha Symphony at 654-9080 or go to their website, which is kenoshasymphony.org. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. We're coming up on 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. We're going to be probing into a term that is bandied about a fair amount, but not very well understood by most of us. That is the term narcissism, or a narcissist. And it turns out that if we look closely, most of us have at least a few narcissists somewhere in our social sphere, somewhere in our lives, among our friends, among our coworkers, in our own families, and yes, maybe we ourselves display certain characteristics of narcissism. As a matter of fact, in the book that we're going to be talking about today called The Narcissist You Know, we learn that there is really kind of a spectrum when it comes to narcissism, and that it can range from fairly mild cases to narcissism run amok, which really is a psychological mental disorder that can really wreak havoc in one's life and especially in one's relationships. The author of this book is Dr. Joseph Burgo, who has been practicing psychotherapy for several decades. He blogs for Psychology Today. He has a website titled psychotherapy.com. And the author of previous books, including The Hero as Narcissist and Why Do I Do That? This latest book is called The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All About Me Age, published by Touchstone. Dr. Joseph Burgo, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So how is it that you have come to see narcissism as something of such significance that it warrants this kind of attention? I mean, is that a realization that came slowly to you, or in a sense, a bit more dramatically?
It came slowly, and it really grew out of this recognition that you can't pick up a paper, or listen to the radio, or read, you know, the news without hearing this word applied. And you hear people say we live in an age of narcissism, and then it grew out of my own work, my clinical work, in which, you know, as I started to realize the importance of shame in my practice, I started understanding how narcissism is a defense against this sense of defect or shame underneath. And it once I started seeing it, it seemed to be rampant. It seemed to be everywhere.
Hmm. And I really appreciate the care with which you approach this, and also the amazing degrees of variety which you find in what most of us tend to think of in very sort of blunt, raw terms. I think most of us think that narcissism is narcissism, and every narcissist is like every other narcissist. And you've taken the time to really delineate it, first of all, in kind of a spectrum of severity, but also different types of narcissism. When did that begin to occur to you, that narcissism was not a simple sort of monolithic term, but one that actually involved a great deal of variation?
It grew a lot out of my clinical practice. Once I started becoming sensitive to narcissism, I could see how it showed up in so many different ways. It, you know, the way the word gets used nowadays is it's kind of like this way to, you know, diss people who think a little too well of themselves. People, you know, that's kind of having a big ego seems to be synonymous with narcissism in most people's view. And then I started looking at a lot of public figures who are regularly denounced as narcissists. You know, it's like take name of any particular person and put narcissist next to it and Google it. Now, Donald Trump, let's use the example. And there are hundreds of thousands of, you know, people who are writing about him online and calling him a narcissist as a put down mostly. That's the way the word mostly gets used. So then I started researching, reading about him, reading biographies, and I did this with a number of people who were profiled in the book, in addition to all of my clients. And I found out that there were so many different ways of expressing narcissism. You know, there are know-it-all narcissists. There are seductive narcissists. There are vindictive narcissists. There's lots of different varieties, and they don't all look alike.
Talk for a moment about this sort of spectrum of severity, the fact that, narcissism can be, I suppose, in a sense, kind of a low-grade condition or characteristic, and it also can range all the way up in severity to the point where it really becomes what we might think of as a disorder. In fact, you tell us that there is a disorder which one can be diagnosed as having involving narcissism. Just how wide a range are we talking about? And is low-grade narcissism something that we should live with and accept?
Sure. Well, I think of the spectrum as being vast, and it includes, on one end, healthy self-esteem. I mean, there's such a thing as healthy narcissism. We want people to feel good about themselves, and there's nothing wrong with that. At the far extreme, on the other end, we have narcissistic personality disorder, which is quite severe and, you know, affects somewhere between 1 to 5% of the population. But there's, you know, an infinite variety of expressions in the middle. The people that I'm talking about in my book tend to be towards the extreme end. They may not quite meet the diagnostic criteria for narcissistic personality disorder. They just fall short, but they're dangerous and they're difficult. The dynamic at the heart of this kind of narcissism is what I refer to. It's the winner-loser dynamic, and that the person with healthy self-esteem leaves room for other people to feel good about themselves. The extreme narcissist has to triumph over somebody else to build himself up. He views the world exclusively in terms of winners and losers. He's always trying to prove that he's a winner, usually by, you know, humiliating somebody else, the loser. So it's the extreme narcissist builds himself up at your expense, which is what makes them so toxic.
And why we have to know how to deal with those if we are unfortunate enough to have such a narcissist in our immediate sphere.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, my general advice to people is to get as far away as possible. I mean, I know that sounds kind of simplistic and cowardly, but these people do not, as a rule, change, and they can be toxic. And if you can get away from them, you know, that's just the best thing to do. I also give a lot of advice in the book about how to cope with them if you can't do that. Sometimes you can't, like they're a family member or they're your boss, or, you know, sometimes you're married to one. So there are ways to cope better with them, but it's really pretty much of a losing proposition. They're people who have little empathy for anybody else, and they don't change, like I said.
We're speaking with Dr. Joseph Burgo, and we're talking about his book called The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All About Me Age. The subtitle of your book suggests that we live in a time in which narcissism maybe is even more rampant than it once was. I mean, if this is indeed an All About Me Age, then it just seems like it's either an age in which narcissism is sort of almost expected and maybe inadvertently encouraged by certain aspects of modern life, or narcissists are becoming more numerous and they're sort of turning this into an all-about-me sort of age. Which do you think is driving the other, or what is it about the times in which we live that make this perhaps an especially acute issue?
I think there's a number of trends that have coalesced that have created this kind of cultural narcissism. I think, you know, if you look back at the greatest generation, to use Tom Brokaw's term, that they had values of humility, self-sacrifice, and service. With the rise of the boomer generation in the 60s, and where self-expression and authenticity became higher values, humility is no longer that big of a deal. I mean, we're not culturally, that's not a value anymore. Now, self-promotion is the ideal. That's what we're all doing on Twitter and Facebook. We're always putting ourselves out there and saying, look at how great we're doing. I think along with that, the rise of celebrity worship in our culture, where the highest good we can imagine is being in the public limelight and making a lot of money and getting a lot of attention. I'm sure you've read the studies that talk about this among, you know, the middle-aged students who would rather be the personal assistant to a celebrity than the president of Harvard. You know, our values have totally changed, and now being famous, being in the limelight, self-promoting, these are the social values we hold.
One of the interesting things you do in your book is examine the way in which narcissism sort of plays out, manifests itself, does its harm with various types of narcissists or in different arenas. And I think one of the most intriguing is the time you take talking about narcissistic parents and narcissistic parenting. Did you also encounter this very directly in your practice? Is that where you sort of encountered this yourself, or more out in the real world, if you know what I mean?
You know, it was both, and in addition, it was coming to terms with myself. That was perhaps the most painful part of it, is when, you know, when I was a young parent, when my kids were little and I was living on the west side of Los Angeles, you know, the desire to, you know, look like you had it all together, like you had the, you know, the perfect family, the dual career couple, you had a nice house. I mean, you know, I was quite chagrined ultimately to realize how much I wanted to look like a winner. And, you know, I had kids who, you know, were impressive in their own ways. And I think a lot of people do that. There's nothing wrong with being, you know, proud of children and wanting to discuss their accomplishments with people that you know. It's when it becomes competitive, when your kids have to be better than other people, when you feel threatened by the accomplishments of your friends' children and that makes you feel like a loser. I mean, this parenting is an arena in which these kind of narcissistic competitive feelings come up a lot. I did see it in my practice. I had several clients who came from kind of troubled backgrounds and wanted to feel that they had, you know, recovered from that and were now producing these, you know, idealized children that kind of disproved all the damage they had suffered in their own childhood. I think that's understandable in a way. It's just when it becomes competitive and doesn't leave room for other people to feel good about their kids that it becomes a problem.
You yourself mentioned the sort of political landscape a little earlier in this interview, and that brings to mind an intriguing question, namely, is a dose of narcissism in someone's personality, in someone's makeup, helpful and perhaps even essential to them being a strong and effective leader? What have you come to believe about that intriguing question?
To answer your question, I would say yes. I think you have to have a healthy dose of narcissism to believe, for instance, that you deserve to be the leader of the Western world. You've got to have a belief in yourself, and you've got to have a pretty thick skin to get through what it takes to, you know, be elected to that office. So I think it can be useful. You know, narcissists often accomplish great things, you know, because they believe so much in themselves and they want to demonstrate their winner status on the world stage. They can accomplish great things. I mean, I talk about Steve Jobs, for instance, who, you know, changed the world. It's a different matter when it veers into this extreme, talk about Trump, where, you know, you can't tolerate criticism and you become indignant or blaming or contemptuous when someone disagrees with you. Then you're not likely to be very successful in holding public office because that's a matter of compromise and respect for other people's opinions.
Ultimately, as you wrote this book and chose to explore narcissism, how much were you thinking, I mean, the subtitle of your book points towards, in a sense, the victims of narcissism. Your book is a means by which for us to understand the narcissists that might be in our lives. Could you imagine a narcissist themselves taking your book in hand and deriving any sort of help from it? Or did you have that thought in mind at all as you wrote it?
I did not have that thought in mind, although what I did have in mind is helping readers to understand the ways in which we're all narcissistic to one degree or another, and that understanding the narcissist you know is often a matter of understanding yourself and the ways that you deal with narcissistic injuries. The original idea for this book is I wanted to write something that would be called like the everyday narcissist. And I was told readers don't want to be told that they're narcissists. So I got the kind of backdoor message. It's an underlying theme that runs throughout it. I mean, these defenses that I've been talking about where narcissists respond to any kind of challenge to themselves, they become indignant, they become blaming, and they often become contemptuous too. I actually think that these are ways that most of us respond. You know, very few people take criticism well. And our first reaction, our first defensive reaction, is often to become indignant. And if it's a relationship fight, to find some way of blaming the other person instead, and even become a little, you know, contemptuous of the other person to invalidate the criticism. I think these are really kind of normal and almost universal. The difference is that most of us will then back down once we get over like being upset. We'll say, oh, well, you know, maybe there was some truth in that criticism, and we might even apologize. For the extreme narcissist, those defensive strategies, indignation, blame, and contempt, are built into their personalities. They're ongoing and relentless, and they never back down. But by seeing the ways that we protect ourselves from hurt, narcissistic injury, feeling criticized, we can understand what the extreme narcissist is doing and hopefully even develop a little bit of compassion for them. That's one of the big messages of the book.
True. And of course, often it's the hardest thing in the world for us to feel compassion for someone who is a narcissist and maybe doing some damage to us and others we care about. But yes,
it's incredibly difficult.
Right. But yes, your book really helps us sort of step beyond the common easy assumptions we make about what is at the root of narcissism, and you really help us understand it so much better. The book again is called The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All About Me Age. The book is published by Touchstone. Its author, Dr. Joseph Burgo. Dr. Burgo, thank you so much. I found the book very, very interesting and helpful, and I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we preview for you the performances coming up this weekend of Giacomo Puccini's great classic Madama Butterfly. On Thursday, we'll be speaking with James Kinchin from UW Parkside about his choir's recent trip to India, and we'll talk with Bob Caporale, the author of an interesting book called Creative Strategy Generation, which uses some musical terms to help business leaders think about strategic planning. And on Friday, a look at an extraordinary Star Trek phenomenon, a web series called Star Trek Continues, which goes to extraordinary lengths to recreate both the look and the feel of Star Trek, the original series. We'll talk to the series creator on Friday's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.